And welcome everyone to another episode of the Developing Up Podcast. I'm your host, Mike Miles, and this is the podcast focused on the non-technical side of being a developer, because your career is about more than the code you write. So if you call yourself a programmer, a developer, a script kiddie, a database administrator, a technologist, a technical architect, whatever you call yourself, if it's your job to write code, this is the podcast for you. And to all the new listeners out there, I want to say welcome. Thanks for joining us. And for all the repeat listeners, hey, thanks for coming back and listening to another episode. And not only is this episode 28, that's 28, but it's also a brand new year. Happy New Year, everyone. Happy 2018. I hope you're excited for a brand new year of opportunities and ways to move forward in your development career. You know, New Year is the time when people start thinking of resolutions and ways they want to improve themselves. And if you're thinking about what you want to do in the upcoming year for your development career, might I recommend to you that you take a listen back to the very first episode of the podcast, episode number one, where we talk about, as a developer, why and how to set goals for yourself. So in today's episode, I sat down and talked with Jonathan Slorsnell Hamilton, who is the Assistant Director of IT Operations and Architecture for the Office of Research Information Systems at UCLA. So you're going to hear us talk about why it's important in your career as a developer to know when you shouldn't be building something yourself. It was a really interesting conversation. Jonathan had a lot to say on this topic. He came with a bunch of examples, and I took a lot away from it. I hope you will also. So pay attention to the examples he has. After the conversation, we'll come back. I'll try to distill it into some key takeaways as usual, and that'll be it. So without further ado, here is the first episode of 2018 for the Development Up Podcast. Why don't you start off by telling us a little bit about yourself and your history related to development?
Sure. So my name is Jonathan Slorsnell Hamilton, and I am currently the Assistant Director for the Office of Research Information Systems at UCLA. I've been working there for just over 6 years. And before that, I worked at the Office of Research Administration at Stanford University in a similar role for a number of years. And I've kind of flirted with development for a long time. When I was in high school, I had a GeoCities site dedicated to the restoration of my 1969 Volkswagen Beetle, and was really proud of myself for getting a zebra stripes background up and running on that HTML. And so I've done a little bit of development off and on, and never really full time until this, you know, last few years at UCLA.
I find it interesting about the number of developers you run into who kind of just started on their own, especially nowadays, you know, in our sort of age range, I guess I'd say, who started with just the GeoCity websites for something they're interested in and just spark an interest. I mean, I started that way too. I remember drawing HTML out by hand in a notebook in high school and getting home to put it up on Angel Fire and start that.
Oh, Angel Fire in the cities, good old days. But I've had a very similar experience in my career. A lot of the people that I've worked with, you know, weren't computer scientists by training or by trade, whatever. I studied physics myself. And when I finished with my undergraduate, I was looking down the path of maybe doing another 5 to 7 years of school and research and whatnot. I really just kind of wanted to get started with a career. So I turned to IT because I'd always done that as a side gig.
Through all those different experiences, you've definitely ran into the need to either build something yourself or use something pre-built, which is why, you know, we're talking today on that topic. And I think it's an important one to be discussed and for people to learn that you don't always have to just go guns blazing and build it yourself.
I definitely learned that under the gun, you know, as some people may have read my Medium post about a rather fiery departure of a senior developer that we had had, you know, one of my prior positions. And that was my first introduction to the world of software packages and the fact that there's this massive open source community out there doing all the hard work for you so that you could just focus on building great tools and solutions. You know, when I opened up the hood on what he had been working on, there was tens of thousands of lines of code devoted to a custom logger, for example. And I thought, well, logging is something that I know exists. I mean, again, I was coming from the operation side, but it's like, you know, our servers, they generate logs. I can't imagine that you can't just go consume some sort of logging code that somebody has built. This is a really common function. So why do we have this totally custom, you know, tightly coupled logging implementation in this really complex business application? And the more layers I pulled back, the more I realized that the whole thing had been built, you know, from the ground up in .NET. I mean, at least he was using a framework, but, you know, everything soup to nuts he had built from scratch.
I mean, there's definitely benefit to building things yourself, but you already highlighted, and I totally agree, where something such as like logging, you know it exists already. You know there's going to be already like a million ways to do it. Why do you have to be that 100 millionth person to revision how to develop logging?
Yeah, and one of the arguments that I hear, and there's some merit to this, is that the only way you ever really understand how something works is if you build it yourself. And that's great as a learning exercise, but you don't have to do that on the company's time every time. You know, you don't have to inflict your best effort at learning something new on your teammates and then give them that technical debt to support from then onward. You know, if you're going to do that, you should at least do it behind an interface so they can pull your work out later and, you know, put something else behind it. But that's totally fine if you want to go reinvent the wheel to learn how wheels work, but you don't have to do it in a context where everyone else is going to be responsible for it.
Yeah, in that situation, abstraction is most definitely your friend. The more you can abstract than put wrappers on top of your specifics, then, like you said, the better your team can then refactor as needed. And I liked what you said about learning is important. I totally agree. I am someone who, for the longest time, just out of spite or just I don't know what, I would refuse to use like an intelligent IDE. I would use Notepad++ because I felt I had to know how to write every function with every parameter. And like I had to know every single line of my code, but you lose time with that. And it's a valuable lesson. But like you said, on your company's dime or for your client is paying for it, it's not always the best use of, you know, the time you have to develop a product or software or a website or whatnot.
Yeah. And, you know, we came up, you know, mentioning the GeoCities and that kind of stuff. I mean, when I came up plinking away at that kind of stuff, Notepad really was the best tool. I mean, you go ahead and use FrontPage if you want. You know, good luck. And, you know, some of the Adobe tools back then were pretty horrendous as well. But now, you know, the world of development is so much more accessible and so many more people are doing it. And I think that that's wonderful and a really good change in innovation. And it means that they're all contributing to this great pool of resources that we don't have to do that way anymore. We can go get an IDE that is fantastic and well-maintained and robust because some much smarter than me engineer got tired of writing stuff in Notepad, you know, and built one. And we can go get packages that do some of these common functions and really just focus our efforts on code that really differentiates our products.
And yeah, that's definitely a big value of reusing existing frameworks. I think it frees up your time as a developer or a team of developers to focus on your specific problems that you're trying to solve and not, you know, like the scaffolding or the things you need to support solving those problems, which, again, your client or your company, you know, may not be paying you to actually do that. They're paying you to deliver that custom piece of functionality that is supported by those products.
If your company or your customer is paying you to do that, if they don't have a very well articulated reason for it, it's actually your job to convince them not to do that. You know, you shouldn't just go blindly off into the night, you know, and forge your own trail, especially when it comes to something like security and authorization. You're really in dangerous territory there, you know, kind of there be dragons. I was really kind of white-haired when I finished our deep dive into the authorization code that had existed before, because there were so many opportunities for various kinds of very well-known kind of routine attacks against this authorization framework that had been built during a development crunch, you know, that had been built by somebody that had never built one before. And why would you expose yourself and your company and your clients to that kind of risk? You know, it's irresponsible at some point.
Yeah, that's a very important point to make, that building it yourself and not making the recommendation to use something that has been developed, has been tested, that has, you know, if it's open source, a community around it to support it, you're taking on all that risk of whatever vulnerabilities may be in that, because we're all under time crunches. And so you try not to build technical debt, but it's going to happen. And then if you don't have time to do it right the first time, you're not going to have time to go back and fix it and do it right.
Thing is, too, that there's always going to be time to go back and get that last 10 or 20% of features that, you know, an existing framework maybe didn't offer you, or really tweak something that's going to be exactly the way you want. One of my favorite analogies to use is the development of the Tesla car. Tesla just had batteries at first. They were like, you know, lead acid batteries are really heavy and that's what makes electric cars really stink. And so they went and found a guy that was making electric cars in California, and they gave him a lithium ion battery and said, stick that in there and let's see how it performs. And that was the first Tesla. Everything else about the car, other than the battery, was pre-made.
I didn't know that.
Yeah. And then when they released their first production car, they actually took the Lotus Elise, you know, which is a really, you know, nice little sports coupe. That had a whole support infrastructure already around it, dealerships and mechanics and parts and logistics and all of that stuff. That's the first car they sold to customers, and they just put their custom electric car engine and batteries inside of it. And it wasn't until much later now we have Tesla's making their own doors and their own self-driving systems and all these other things that they just leveraged before from pre-existing technologies and pre-existing solutions, because their differentiation at first was just range and speed. Let's lighten them up. Let's make them go a really long ways, because that's where electric cars stink. Now they're to the point where, because they've succeeded at that, they've been able to identify more targeted differentiation points and build even more value for their customers with fancier features and so on, because they focused on getting the real core of their business right first. You know, and I imagine if they had started out by saying, let's build 500 dealerships across the country and hope for the best, they may not be successful today.
Yeah, that's a very good point. So they focused on the problem they needed to solve and used other technologies to solve the problems they didn't need to focus on until they had the availability to do so and really differentiate themselves.
Yeah. And, you know, sometimes it goes the other way, too. I heard that when Netflix first got started, you know, I mean, cloud storage really wasn't a thing. And so they built their whole platform from the ground up. But once they really got their momentum going, suddenly, you know, here comes Amazon and they're just dumping money, you know, buckets of money into building this cloud infrastructure that nobody had heard of before. And Netflix realized, you know what, we're not really differentiating ourselves anymore by dumping, you know, hundreds of thousands of dollars in technical resources into custom cloud storage, because that's not who we are. And so they actually cut that from their product and went over to S3 and, you know, were able to focus their remaining resources on new differentiation, new content. You know, now Netflix has its own series, Stranger Things, things like that, because they can spend money on that because they're not spending money on stuff that somebody else has made into a commodity.
So if you want to go and build your own cloud infrastructure nowadays, you should just go into the upside down is what you're telling me.
It looks like there's a lot of market opportunity there. I mean, certainly there's no competitors, and I think that scary monsters have to store their you know, family photos somewhere too.
Yeah, so. Yeah. Everybody has data they need to store. So I think that's just a great highlight of the benefits for developers to think of abstractly is that, you know, already in your day-to-day, you're not building everything you need to do your job from the ground up. So really thinking about when you're working on your development project, what are the things you really need to build yourselves, and what are the things you can find that already exist that have the infrastructure you need or your clients need that you can convince them to use is the value of reusing existing frameworks or tools.
Yeah, I mean, it really lets you focus on getting that minimum viable product up and running. I mean, that's a big, you know, buzzword in, you know, entrepreneurship and startup circles and stuff. But really, what you need to do is build your differentiation first. Everything else can be stuff that you wire together that somebody else has built for you. And once you've proved your product and proved your business model, then you can move on to building a better logger if that's really what, you know, your customers need, or that's what's gonna bring in the new people.
I would like to hear what you think are some guidelines or ways to really think about and understand what it is that you need to build yourself and how to identify what you don't need to build.
That's where one of the most important skills I think that's really undersold in development comes in, which is that you need to learn the business that you're operating in. You can't just be a really good coder and, you know, that's enough anymore, if it ever was. I think that that's something that, especially those of us that kind of came into coding from maybe more of a freelance perspective, we kind of get used to kind of hit and run and not really getting deep, you know, into the technology that we're building. But once you're on a serious long-term project, you know, that's when especially you really need to be able to talk to the customer and figure out, okay, well, you're telling me that you need this, but what do you really need? You know, developers do need to think outside the box a bit. We need to find out what the business pain is that our customers are experiencing, and then figure out where the differentiation is that we can offer that will help them resolve that pain. And I would argue, jumping back a bit, I guess, arguing against myself on the freelance side, it's an important skill for freelancers too, because you're not going to be able to get as many gigs or get as much work done or work as effectively if you are constantly reinventing the wheel as well. Like, you do need to learn how to identify that customer pain point, even if you're moving from business to business. And so I guess if you're in one place, it's nice because at least you can really focus on just learning the business. If you're moving around a lot, you need to learn how to talk to customers and learn their business quickly so that you can identify where you can bring the most value with your efforts, because it's probably not going to be with something that 20,000 people have already built before you.
If you are a freelance developer, you probably need to focus on that more than if you, like you just said, if you're someone who has your one job that you work at this one place doing this one thing. It's great to learn, and it's definitely beneficial to learn what your whole business is about. But if you're a freelancer, since you have to jump between so many businesses, having the skills to quickly learn that, it's going to save you time and really focus what you need to do to help that company build their product.
Yeah, and if you're an enterprise developer too, it's still an important skill to have. Sure, you can lean on your project managers and your product managers, but I don't know how many times you've heard people complaining about, oh, the PM promised this and now we have to crunch because the deadline's coming up and so on. You know, and if you can speak that language and you can get involved in the business side and you can help guide the conversation about what needs to be built and how it needs to be built and not just sit there and write code as fast as you can when you get your assignments, you can really help manage up and improve your whole company's outlook and your own life and work-life balance as well.
And as well as having that skill to talk to those sides of the business allows you to better articulate, you know, as a developer, why something has to be built a certain way or why a tool is better to use. If you can put that, you know, almost into English terms for your project managers, the people who are less technical, it makes it easier to, I don't want to say sell them, but just to convince them, you know, you're the expert, this is why you're explaining it, and they understand your motives for why you're building what you're building.
Well, no, I mean, I think sell is a perfectly fine term to use. I think that that's something that, you know, maybe those of us that are more technical are used to operating environments where we have, you know, sort of rational discussions, and our conceit is that we tell ourselves that the most logically correct argument wins. I don't know that that really ever happens, but I think that's the lie that we tell ourselves to feel superior sometimes. But really, we do have to sell our ideas, and we do have to make clear the value in terms that matter to the business. You know, if you go to them and you say, well, if we do this, we're going to be adding technical debt, they're not really going to relate to that. But if you say, hey, if you want this feature today, that's great. I can do it this way that you've specified, but that's the only feature you're going to get for the next 6 months because I'm going to be fixing it afterwards, you know, after it goes into production every day. But hey, if you want to get 10 new features in the next year, maybe we can kind of slim this down a bit. You know, it is a bit of a sales pitch, but it will yield a lot of value for you. A few years ago, I mentioned that I had this project where we kind of had to come in and seize the reins from this developer who left under pretty extraordinary circumstances. And, you know, he had left behind this massive legacy code base where everything was built from scratch. And we had 6 months to rebuild what he had taken 5 years to build with a couple of other people. And, you know, there were, you know, four of us, and, you know, there had been four of them, and we had to do 10 times the work, you know, in an equivalent time span, or work 10 times faster. So we could work 10 times faster and do 10 times as much coding, but they were already pulling 60, 70, 80 hour weeks before we came on board. So that clearly wasn't going to work. We couldn't work a 700 hour week. And, you know, being honest, the guys that left were really talented and they were really good at putting out code really quickly. You know, they had poor judgment because they were building stuff they didn't need to build. And that was where we could differentiate. You know, we said, okay, well, we can't build 10 times the stuff, you know, in the same amount of time. But what we can do is build 1/10 the stuff because we can pick what we actually need to build. And a little bit of that was negotiating with the customer on reducing the scope of the project. You know, there had been some pieces of the project scope that were, you know, not well articulated. And we did manage to convince the customer that some of the things they had asked for were just not obtainable. But they'd already been waiting for 5 years. So they weren't exactly in a mood to negotiate down on what they were going to get. So the rest of it really came to internally taking a look at the code base and saying, okay, well, we have to redo this. We have to get this whole product up and running. We can't work with any of what's here. How can we build it up from scratch? And the way we were able to do it is just go and consume third-party packages that were already available to do all the stuff that had been built from scratch. And that was the first time I'd really come to grips with the idea that, hey, maybe there's stuff out there that we could use. And I realized now there's actually robust, you know, open source communities and even for-pay indie devs that'll release packages that'll solve your problems. Now, pretty affordably, when you look at the cost of doing it yourself and assuming all that technical debt, you can go pay somebody $5,000 and get, you know, a really great graphing package or something like that, you know, that you would probably have to spend 6 months working on yourself.
Is that what you talked about in your article? What's the title? We fired our top talent. Best decision we ever made.
That's exactly it. Yeah, that was, you know, my experience with third-party packages was born out of desperation.
And I will say, I very much enjoyed reading that article when you put it out, especially using Rick from Rick and Morty, because I thought it was a perfect analogy for somebody, knowing it's not Rick was not the person's real name. So you just made it an interesting read, just as a side note. I really enjoyed it.
Oh, thank you. I'm glad to hear it.
All right. So why don't we talk a few guidelines on, as a developer, how you might go about choosing or evaluating existing frameworks in knowing if they're the best fit for your project or problem. I have some ideas. I don't know if you have any tips or ideas on how developers can approach that.
Sure. I mean, you know, I have a few kind of quick things that I always go through first. So really it's about risk analysis. So you're trading one risk, you know, the technical debt that you're doing for yourself and, you know, assuming another risk, which is somebody else controls part of your product. And you did a great podcast on risk, I think, to open the season, by the way. So
thank you.
This is kind of one of those overt versus covert risk situations. The covert risk is just plowing ahead and doing it yourself. And, you know, so it may seem like, oh, well, I actually have to analyze if I'm going to go use somebody else's code. It's pretty easy to get some surface indications and kind of take the temperature of a package out there. First, you can go to reputable sources, GitHub, SourceForge, and you can participate in these communities and get to know who kind of is reputable and what's out there. You can also just look at the statistics and the metrics that they post. You know, if a lot of people are consuming a package, that's probably a good sign that it's got community support, that it's going to be maintained. You can look at when the last commits were to the package. You know, is it being updated regularly? You know, and that's actually really important to do, especially if you're kind of primarily going from how many people have downloaded as your first pass. Because there are some cases where packages, even if they're popular, get abandoned and the community has moved on to something else, but you know, some package had 6 years of momentum behind it, so it still has a million downloads. So you have to look at those kind of things and evaluate, is it fresh? Is it being kept up to date with the latest, you know, version of the framework I'm running in? You know, another thing to look at is look at its history when there have been major releases. So for example, you know, when Python went from 2 to 3, or you know, with the recent release of Rails 5, I think it was, you know, go and look and see like how hard of a time did these guys have in their commit history if it's open source, you know, getting this package, you know, brought up in line with the new specification. How long was it in alpha or beta before they released? Those are some kind of ways that you can check and see is the community really behind it. And the last thing is that, you know, that I do is some packages have a lot of money behind them. A perfect example in today's world is React, you know, which has billions of Facebook dollars behind it, or Bootstrap from Twitter, you know, and as long as those companies aren't having really prohibitive licenses or other problems that, you know, might restrict your use of them. And as long as they're still supporting them, those are good places to start, because, you know, big companies are going to take some time to shift momentum. And so, you know, you'll probably have enough of an advance warning to go find an alternative if they're going to ramp down their support for a package like that.
You stole all of my points, all my guidelines. I don't want to reiterate what you said. The only other part I might add, when evaluating packages or frameworks or whatnot, if they have like issue queues of some sort, so if it's on GitHub, there's the issue queue. If there's any way to check like on forums or whatnot, see how responsive they are to when problems do arise, when people are having a hard time using their software. Like look to see how, not easy, but I guess how easy it is to find solutions for if you do run into problems with the frameworks you choose to use. Can you reach the original developers or a community behind that software who then can help you solve those problems to integrate it into your project or, you know, your package?
Yeah, that's really true. You know, that's a really important indicator, because sometimes they work great and they're really well documented, you know, the more popular ones. But if you have maybe an edge case, maybe there is a package out there that's got 20 or 30 or 40,000 downloads. So it's not some one-off that you're never going to see again. But you know, maybe the developers haven't had time to really address a lot of issues, and that can help you decide between, say, maybe two smaller competing solutions, who's really out there being responsive. One gotcha I will, you know, also tell you to do is to make sure that you're looking at the licenses before you go use these things, you know, so you just want to make sure that the licenses are compatible with what you want to do with your product. You know, just make sure that you're, you know, respecting the wishes of the original creators and that you're paying attention to what they want you to do with the licenses. It's really not that much extra work. You know, it could save you some hassle down the line.
And you brought up React before, and we had seen, you know, not too long ago, a couple of months ago, there was a whole problem with licensing with React, and Facebook had to go in and relicense React and how they're distributing it, because people were kind of not happy with some of the implications of the license.
Yeah, and they were using a fairly esoteric one. And so maybe that's another gotcha to look for is, you know, MIT, super common, you know, Apache 2.0, super common, GPL or LGPL, those are pretty common. But if you see other stuff out there, just make sure you really read and understand what you're signing up for, because, you know, I think the problem people had with Facebook's license was that it waived your right to sue Facebook forever for any reason, you know, or something crazy like that. And they had to go and change it to one of the more mainstream licenses.
You laid out a whole bunch of points. I hope the developers listening have gotten to take away a couple of ideas of to know when to use existing tools or frameworks and when to build it themselves. So I have one last question for you, Jonathan. What would be your one piece of advice for developers in their development career?
Very broadly, the most important thing to do is to learn how to be humble. If you don't already, you know how to be humble. You know, I've been humbled many times in my career. Perhaps the most valuable experience I had in my physics education was having a Nobel laureate tell me that I was stupid in a presentation in front of the entire class and demand that I explain myself in better terms. So, you know, when he tells you you're stupid, you got to take that seriously. It cuts you back a notch. So I think that maintaining humility is important because it makes us, you know, keep an open mind about what we need to learn and about our own limits. And in the context of packages, you know, really it's about knowing your limits. You know, you have to recognize that there's only a certain number of hours in the day and there are only a certain number of days in the week. And unless you want to give more of those to your clients or to your, you know, organization, whoever you're working for, you are best served by recognizing that you need to really focus your efforts on what's important and not go out and, you know, find a bunch of wheels to reinvent, because developing is great, but there's other things to do with your time. And, you know, maybe it's not so great if you're just reinventing something that somebody else has already done for you.
So be humble. I think that is advice anyone can take. Thank you for sharing that. I really appreciate that. I think that's a great piece of advice.
Yeah, of course. Thank you for having me on your show.
Yeah, I like the little East Coast meets West Coast thing we got going on here.
Yeah, maybe we'll meet at a conference in Chicago someday in the middle.
One day, maybe. We'll see.
Yeah.
All right, Jonathan, thank you for being on the podcast. I appreciate you taking the time.
Yeah, thank you very much for having me. I appreciate being here.
And once again, I want to thank Jonathan for being on the podcast. That was a really great conversation. I had a lot of fun talking to him. If you want to know more about Jonathan, you can find him on Twitter at JHSolor. That is JHSOLOR. Or you can find him on Medium at Peach Pie. I link in the show notes to his article that we talked about a couple of times in the episode, as well as some articles about the history of Tesla and Netflix moving to AWS if you want to know more about those examples. So just a couple takeaways that I had from this conversation. Building everything yourself comes with risks, and it has a big chance to incur technical debt, not only for you, but for your team. So keep that in mind when you are building your solutions. Focus your efforts on building what's important, what differentiates your project from everything else. And then for anything that doesn't do that, any code that's not seeking to accomplish that, try to use something that already exists. And finally, as a professional, it is part of your job to not only inform your clients, your company, your project managers, whomever, to sell them on the idea that it's not best to build everything yourself and to articulate to them the risks that are involved with that and the benefits they could get by using some third-party software when appropriate. And if you want to share your further thoughts and opinions about this episode or any episode or just development in general, there's a number of outlets you can use. So there's the website, developingup.com, that features our full library of recorded episodes with show notes and sections for comments and conversations. You can find us on Twitter at DevUpPodcast or myself personally at MikeMiles86, or send a good old-fashioned email at hello@developingup.com or to me at Mike@developingup.com. And I'd greatly appreciate your help in reaching a wider development audience if you could leave a rating and review on iTunes or Stitcher or Google Play or wherever you get your podcast. It helps other developers find this podcast and get better at their careers. So until the next episode, I wish you happy developing.